you know, somebody with a Ford F-150 or something who can, you know, technically pull your smaller tiny house, but at the same time, you know, you hit that kind of wind shear or some kind of thing on the road and, you know, the chaos can still happen. But with a truck where these guys pull these things, you know, for their entire lives, you know, they know the road.
Welcome to the Tiny House Lifestyle Podcast, the show where you learn how to plan, build, and live the tiny lifestyle. I'm your host, Ethan Waldman, and today I'm thrilled to introduce our guest, Mike Crowhurst, a seasoned tiny house dweller and the creative mind behind one of the most unique tiny homes I've seen in a while. Mike and his wife, Heidi, spent 3 years crafting a 45-foot, ex-refrigerated semi-trailer into a gorgeous tiny home. Throughout this episode, we'll dive into Mike's journey of tiny house living, exploring not just the practical aspects like custom cabinetry and space-saving features like an innovative elevator bed, but also the sustainable lifestyle that drives him. We'll also get into the nitty-gritty of converting a semi-trailer into a comfortable and functional living space, addressing the challenges and rewards such a project brings. So buckle up as we get a tour of Mike's impressive tiny home and learn how he has optimized every inch of this space for maximal living. I am here with Mike Crowhurst. Mike is an ethically and sustainably driven minimalist who has journeyed for over the past decade with his wife, Heidi, in search of ways to be kinder to the planet, its people, and themselves. Compassionate choices have led them to tiny house living with a lower personal footprint, lower cost, and lower stress. Mike Crowhurst, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And I have to say, you know, I've been doing this show for a long time. I've seen probably about a million tiny houses, plus or minus. Seeing your home was, I felt really excited about a tiny home. And it's been a little while since I saw one where I was like, wow, this is really, really interesting, really just personalized, and just a great idea. So, and maybe we could just start off because, you know, podcasting is such a audio medium. People aren't going to see you or see me or really be able to see right. Your tiny home.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us, maybe just like describe your tiny home the way that you would describe it to someone who isn't seeing it.
Yeah. Well, when we mentioned that we live in a tiny house to people, then I think the image that people immediately have, because, you know, tiny houses have been popularized over the recent years, they kind of imagine the cute little pitched roof, you know, something timber or whatever. And then we say, oh, actually ours was built out of a 45-foot ex-refrigerated semi-trailer. And then they're like, oh, okay. Because then, of course, the vision is a long, narrow, dark box kind of thing. So, yeah, we have kind of turned that into something that when you're inside, it doesn't feel like you're in a long, dark box. It feels like a bright, friendly, kind of, I guess, Moroccan / cabin-y styled kind of place. So, yeah, very, very different. I think a lot of people have to see it before they can actually kind of really appreciate what we've done with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think that our listeners are going to be really interested to hear about the semi-trailer aspect of it, because I don't think I've ever interviewed anyone who did a tiny home semi-trailer. And in a lot of ways, I suppose it's kind of like the cousin of using a shipping container. But can you talk about, you know, why you chose a semi-trailer? And, you know, what else you considered along the way, and maybe why you decided against those other options?
Yeah, I think we definitely considered the sort of traditional tiny house kind of idea. We were, for many years, we were, you know, looking at, you know, the little timber sort of style house that I was talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the loft kind of was always a sticking point for us. We're like, how are we going to do the loft so that it's kind of really livable? And I've seen designs since that make that work, but kind of at the time we were kind of a bit stuck with that idea. And then we came across this kind of old guy that was actually living in a semi-trailer house already. And he's like, you know, come with me, let me show you what I'm doing. And we were kind of blown away by the amount of space that we, you know, that's afforded by living in a trailer.
Yeah.
And then some of the other virtues, like he was saying, look, if you don't have building experience, which, you know, neither of us really did, you've got insulated walls all ready to go. You've got a roof. you've got a very roadworthy, thing that was built for the road. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to worry about, the dangers of, moving it around and potentially tipping over and all that. And just the idea that you could just literally cut out a window and cut out a door and then stick it in there without having to worry about framing it up and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
So initially it was kind of the ease of building that really appealed to us. Plus they're actually just really cheap to come by. Like it actually was more affordable by a long shot than actually starting with a trailer. Like in Australia, a tiny house trailer costs about anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 Australian dollars.
Yeah.
Which is probably sort of in the 8K range for US. Whereas we bought this whole, 45 foot, fully enclosed walls and everything trailer for probably like $3,000 US.
Wow.
So you've cut out all sorts of extra costs right off the bat.
That's amazing too. And the fact that it was a refrigerated trailer means that there was some insulation already in those walls. And my kind of brain is computing like, wow, that saves you a lot of money, but also it's one of the biggest downsides of a shipping container is that you just have this metal box that you then have to deal with all of the insulation and climate issues that are going to come with conditioning the inside space of a metal box.
That's right. Yeah. And actually shipping containers I'm sure there's people out there with great shipping container houses, and I don't want to kind of knock them or anything, but they structurally can be very difficult to build with.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sort of failings to that kind of design. Plus they're a lot harder to work with, obviously.
Yeah.
So yeah, we kind of were warded off of going that direction pretty early on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The semi-trailer, because it's made of a fiberglass kind of sandwiched wall as well. Mm-hmm. The fiberglass is incredibly strong. Like it's actually, on the vertical, it's as strong as any kind of material.
Yeah.
But then it's also easy to work with. So.
So it's essentially like a structural insulated panel, like each.
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically. Yeah.
And do you know how much insulation is in those semi-trailer walls? Like what the R value of them is?
I don't actually know what the R value is. Yeah. That's a hard one to actually find out. I mean, it's not an extruded polystyrene. It's kind of a very dense foam. Okay. I don't know. It's kind of an unusual foam.
Okay.
I mean, the downside, of course, is, you don't know where these things have been.
Sure.
You're getting a vehicle that could be like 30 years old.
Right.
The foam itself is already starting to probably degrade a little bit in the walls. So that's the caveat.
Sure. Now, did you add any insulation or was that adequate for your climate? And what is the climate like where you live now?
We live in Adelaide in Australia. So it's the southern kind of end. So it's a very dry. It's basically got Mediterranean / sort of California.
Okay.
Southern California kind of, it's that kind of zone. So dry. Generally hot, like very dry heat, and then kind of mild winters, like not super cold. So we don't have to worry about obviously, really insulating it for cold.
Right, right.
I did actually add insulation. So probably the floor has got about, like a half a foot of insulation.
Okay.
And then the roof probably about the same. And then I also put a sort of a drop ceiling into ours that has, so I could put kind of lighting and so on. And that's a traditional SIP kind of panel, like styrofoam,
nice.
And MDF around it kind of thing.
Very cool.
So yeah, it's pretty insulated. We've added really quite heavy duty double glazing around it as well. So yeah, you do feel like it's actually quite, it's doing a good job on those hot 40 something Celsius days.
Yeah.
It's a little more extreme, but yeah, it does a pretty good job generally.
That's awesome. Yeah, and that was one thing that I noticed about the tour, which it was recently featured on Living Big in a Tiny House, and we'll put the link to that on the show notes page for the episode. But you created different levels inside of the house, like kitchen, I think, you step up into it, which helps to really break up that long, 40-something foot box or rectangle.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's also cool that there was the headroom in this structure to do that to start. I know, shipping containers aren't that tall. And also, you know, if you go with something like an ambulance or a van or like a lot of these other vehicles, the headroom is not necessarily always there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's a standard thing. I'm sure all these different trailers have different heights and so on. It's 2.7 meters. So I'm not sure what that is in feet. Yeah. Probably like about a 9-foot mm-hmm. ceiling kind of thing. 9 or 10 feet. So yeah, it's definitely got the space. So by putting a step up, like you say, in the kitchen, which kind of breaks up that space kind of throughout the space, we didn't really lose all that much kind of at the high end. I mean, when Bryce was doing the Living Big thing, you know, he was quite comfortably in there, not feeling like, I think he's like 6 foot.
Yes.
Four
Bryce is very tall.
He didn't feel too, you know, squished in there in a way that he felt uncomfortable. So that was good.
Nice.
Plus we punched a skylight in the kitchen as well. Okay. So that kind of gives you a feeling of a bit of airiness as well.
How does one go about procuring a semi-trailer, and what are some considerations that people should look for in terms of the quality of it? Like, are there issues with rust or like other things to look out for?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's like I was saying, it's an old vehicle. So it depends on how much you think you're going to move it, whether you think the chassis kind of needs a lot of attention. A friend of ours also lives in, we've actually got a little bit of a semi-trailer community. Ah. You know, we don't live in a community, but we know about 5 people that have done the same thing in our area.
Nice.
And one girl actually had her entire chassis undercarriage sandblasted and then repainted.
Wow.
So she was, you know, she wanted to make sure that she had it for the long haul kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, like in our case, actually, I probably wouldn't have actually bought the trailer that we had if I thought about it now, because
okay,
something like a forklift had gone inside of it and had punched into the actual ceiling.
Okay.
Which delaminated the fiberglass a bit.
Ah.
So I've had a lot of problems with the roof because it's kind of got a bit of a dip in it, so it collects water. Ah. And then I had some leaking through the skylight. We've got a second trailer, which we are just sort of fitting out at the moment, and it's got a perfect roof, like absolutely flat. The water never sits on it. So that would be a huge consideration, just making sure that you sort of do a good once over and get a bit of history of the vehicle.
Yep.
But other than that, you know, like you've got, you do have things like giant tires to consider and, you know, like those kind of things that occasionally do need to be replaced and stuff. But
sure.
Yeah.
And then in terms of finding one, are there companies that just sell them, or did you kind of just have to go out searching on like Facebook Marketplace for a used semi-trailer?
Yeah. I mean, if I was sort of telling somebody now, I'd say just go straight to a trucking company and just say, well, what do you do with your, you know, when you put your old ones out to pasture kind of thing, like what happens?
Yeah.
There is actually buy and sell kind of classified, you know, websites or papers or whatever that do sell old stuff as well. The guy that we bought it from, the old guy that got us onto it, he had sort of a broker who kind of looked out for them, for him, because he resold them as kind of a way he made money in his retirement years.
Yeah.
So yeah, that if you're in the know with someone who's kind of aware of these things, then that helps as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. Because I know that, you know, using like, for example, a decommissioned U-Haul trailer is something that people do here. And that's, you know, there are companies, U-Haul, I believe, directly sells them too. But it's good to know where to look out. I think that the advice of, you know, trying to find a company that has a whole bunch of them on the lot is probably wise, because then you can compare several of them and say, okay, this one has a ceiling that's been punctured and that one looks better.
Yeah, yeah. And you're just going to pay proportionate to its age generally.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to tell. I mean, they don't have odometers on them, so you can't really see what kind of mileage they've done. But yeah, I mean, it's actually pretty easy to get underneath them and see, you know, if it looks like it's kind of going to crumble apart.
Right, right.
At some point.
So I suppose that they're quite easy to move, but also that not yourself, like you have to hire a trucking company to come with a tractor and pull it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is an actual complete virtue, because, you know, like you've got people with, you know, somebody with a Ford F-150 or something, you can, you know, technically pull your smaller tiny house, but
yeah.
at the same time, you hit that kind of wind shear or some kind of thing on the road, and you know, the chaos can still happen. But with a truck where these guys pull these things, you know, for their entire lives, you know, they know the roads and how to deal with them.
Yeah.
They've got the big rig. I mean, big rigs cost a lot as well. Yep. So, you know, it's just easy just to pay a guy a few hundred dollars and he'll kind of move it professionally for you.
So is your intention to ever move this home, or is it, you know, are you trying to stay put?
We built it actually in sort of a rural area, about a couple, 100 miles from where we are located now. And then we had it relocated to sort of our forever home, hopefully.
Okay.
So we're in a beautiful spot right now. We're kind of nestled in the vines in a kind of a wine area.
Nice.
So it's really quite a perfect spot. And we really like the hosts of our land. So hopefully we wouldn't have to move. But at the same time, both my wife and I are really kind of interested in living in community as well.
Okay.
That's a bit of a challenge in Australia because there's a lot of resistance to allowing people just to live in like a tiny house community for some reason.
Interesting.
So if something interesting came up, we would love to kind of be able to, you know, maybe consider moving it if it was mm-hmm. the right fit. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it is like, because like when you look at the inside of it, it looks so just intricately made that I'm like, I'm worried about it on the road, but I'm sure that you have ways of kind of securing everything and getting everything to be, you know, stable for a move.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, honestly, I don't know. I haven't really talked to people that have other tiny types of tiny houses, mm-hmm. how they fare with mm-hmm. that kind of thing. If you really have to lock it down.
Yeah.
Our particular one, we like the one particular van that we chose, mm-hmm. we liked because it had air suspension.
Ah.
And apparently air suspension is just really smooth on the road.
Nice.
So when we, I had completely built the house in this other location and we had it shifted and everybody, even people who work in the trucking industry were like, that thing's going to break apart on the road. And it arrived like with literally like two little cracks that were very easy to repair. Mm. And, you know, everything was perfectly intact. So I was like, phew, okay, good. Obviously I built it well enough. And this thing was smooth enough on the road that it absolutely wasn't a problem.
Is there any drywall?
No, there's no drywall. Yeah. I kind of made sure to not make things that were kind of brittle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if anything, because I built it myself, I probably heavily over-engineered it. So it's built like a tank.
I'll bet. So it's got some really great special features. And this is one of the things that I love about the tiny house movement. And I think something that's not been lost, but, you know, as fewer people are able to build their own tiny houses, they're a little bit more generic. So like in my tiny house, I have a hidden cat door under the couch so that the cat that we had at the time could actually go in and out from the tiny house, but it was completely invisible to the outside. So that was like my little special secret feature, but you've got two that I love, and I want to talk about both of them. The first one is the trash chutes. Can you just kind of describe, again, this is like a visual thing. I'll try to put a picture of the trash chutes in the show notes, but, tell me about the trash and the recycling chute.
Yeah, it's, as I said in the video, it's kind of something that to me was like a big deal to get right.
Yeah.
Because I don't like taking out the trash.
Yeah.
One of the virtues of being high up is that we can, you know, like put things around and underneath the actual trailer. So I thought, well, it's kind of the perfect setup then for a long drop kind of mm-hmm. Thing for the trash mm-hmm. and the recycling. So I built two little basically very small little hatches, kind of like your cat door kind of mm-hmm. idea, you know, just like two little things built into the wall of the kitchen. You open the hatch and then there's just basically, it's almost like, well, it is. It's ducting that I found, like just sort of old ducting.
Yeah.
So there's a ducted shaft that goes down to kind of a wheelie bin for both each of the garbage and the recycling. So effectively, it's just like a throwaway and forget kind of thing. You open it up, get rid of your stuff. You know, you don't have to do anything else. And then once the bin's full, you just take it out to the curbside and it's done.
Love it.
So yeah, it's it's very, very simple, but it's a big lifestyle kind of improvement over places I've lived in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's essentially like a laundry chute for trash.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. If you've lived in like an apartment building that has like a garbage chute kind of thing, then yes, you kind of understand the principle.
Yeah. And then the other feature that I love is the elevator bed. So in your bedroom, you can actually lift the bed all the way up to the ceiling. It tucks away really nicely. And then you can use that space for other things. Was that always part of the plan, or is that something that like you thought of while you were doing the bedroom up?
Yeah, it came sort of early-ish. Yeah, I actually built, I did a whole sort of video series of documenting kind of the build and so on.
Nice.
And I did an early kind of scale model of how I imagined the elevator bed would work. And I was kind of thinking, you know, like you kind of had to integrate that early on if I was going to do it.
Yep.
I mean, we definitely had the Murphy bed was kind of as a possible, and we like this idea of having, you know, if the listeners sort of eventually see the design, got kind of little Moroccan cutouts and features throughout the place. We really like to have a feature wall that you could always see. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the Murphy bed being up just kind of blocked that. And so we thought, okay, well, how could we get rid of this thing otherwise? And utilize the bedroom space. And so the elevator bed, I started looking into it, and elevator beds are actually quite pricey if you look at the kind of pre-made kind of commercial versions. And so I thought, well, how could I do this otherwise? Found a couple of simple designs online and so on, and just basically went and modified it my own way. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, how do you get the weight for the thing to work? And there was people getting rid of exercise machines like all over the place. You know, they spend like $2,000 on an exercise machine and realize it's not for them, and then they sell it for like $200.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, sweet. Okay. There's just like, you know, tons of weight on these things. So basically it's like an exercise machine on the outside of the trailer in a kind of a little cabinet.
Yeah.
And it just counteracts the weight of the bed. And it actually, I'm really surprised that it worked as well as it did.
Yeah. It's awesome. I mean, it literally looks like one of those weight machines with the stacked plates, just with some, And it's clever. It's nice to know that there's like weight holding it up at the other end rather than like springs or like hydraulic things. I would feel more confident being under it, knowing that it's like being counterbalanced by heavy weights.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had to learn a little bit about, you know, wire rope kind of weight limits and tensions and stuff like that. Yeah. And, you know, it's all with pulley systems. And I've had people since say, oh, did you do this and that with pulleys, and, you know, to make it really easy. Mm-hmm. I was like, nope, just pretty straightforward. Just like, you know, a pulley and a pulley on the other side. But, you know, probably there's ways you could engineer it to be even more smooth.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you say, it feels like you're safe under the thing. That said, I don't know what would happen if all the wires broke at once. And
I don't think you're going to find that out. Let's hope not.
Let's hope not. Yeah. But yeah, like you say, I mean, the main reason for doing it was to free up that space. And that's actually been a really useful space to have, because I can use it as a desk, and we've used it as a dining room for guests. And that just changes the whole dynamic of, you know, being in a tiny house, if you can create a whole new room when you need it.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the build itself. I think in the video you said it took about 3 years. Was that 3 years working on it full time, part time? Like how did that all play out?
It was reasonably full time, I guess. It happened to perfectly coincide with like the COVID pandemic. So
okay,
just by coincidence. So it was okay for me to have. It was great to have a project while I was, you know, not able to go anywhere anyway, other than being able to get to the hardware store. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was pretty much full time, and my wife, who's a graphic designer, was able to kind of just keep us afloat.
Yeah.
And we were living in this rural space that we had very cheap rent, and so there wasn't a lot of pressure on me to have to to work as well. So, and I guess the benefit of that was that, you know, not being a builder, I could take my time, I could learn things, and it afforded us the ability to do kind of the more complex, or, you know, things that maybe, you know, like you were saying, in more sort of straightforward builds these days.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have the time or the money maybe to do.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was great having that kind of just breathing room to do it. So it could have been done faster. And I'm sure if I did it again, I probably literally could do it in half the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it took about 3 years, wow, more or less, for full time.
Wow. And then, like, technically for the build, there's a photo that we'll put on the show notes page. It's kind of, the finished walls aren't up yet, and it's kind of looking at the raised area. And I'm curious, because I see your wire runs. It looks like you used, like, strapping up against the inside of the walls. And that's where you've put your wire runs, and then I'm assuming that the finished walls just attach right to that strapping.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, we didn't want to encroach on the living space, obviously, very much, but I also didn't want to cut into the walls too much, so that I kind of weakened. In my perception, I really didn't know. I thought if I started doing huge long vertical cuts or something, that it might actually cause a weakness in that wall.
Right.
So yeah, it was just, you know, like, it was just the wire depth, basically, was the strapping,
yeah,
and then just put the wall over top of that. So very different than, yeah, a conventional framing build.
Absolutely. And then it looks like I can see at least one drawer hidden in that kind of raised section. Is that where a lot of the utilities are? Like, are there water tanks? Like, what's in that raised floor section?
Basically, we wanted it to be, yeah, take advantage of as much storage as we possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
I think I worked it out. It was like 3 cubic meters, which I don't know. Again, mm-hmm. I don't know what that would be in cubic feet that we gained in extra space just by raising it a foot off the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So there's basically a huge drawer under the living room.
Uh-huh.
And there's kind of the main step that goes up into the kitchen actually flips up. I had to do all this tricky stuff with hinges.
Okay.
And masking the hinge and so on. But there's a giant drawer there that's like, yeah, about 8 feet deep and probably about 4 feet wide.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's 3 drawers in the bedroom that all come out from different spots, and then another drawer under the work desk that my wife has. So
nice.
We mostly use that space for that. But then there's also space for air conditioning duct, air conditioning heating. There's space for putting all the wiring for all the electrical stuff comes into one point under the floor there. Yeah, so we did that whole space is very well used,
yeah.
But it was actually quite good to have that place to hide stuff.
Yeah, well, the house has an abundance of storage space in the tour. It's just amazing how you've managed to fit custom cabinetry and drawers in so many different places, but it doesn't look like, you know, you could risk closing a space down, putting too much storage and too much cabinetry in, and it looks really bright and open.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that was just sort of lucky that we were able to design it in such a way. I mean, it's 320 square feet floor space. So, you know, it's reasonably big for a tiny house. So yeah, I guess we were able to kind of, you know, encroach a little bit on the kind of living space with stuff without it feeling like we were kind of making a huge impact, like maybe some smaller tiny houses. And I went cabinetry crazy, you know, in there. The one little bit of carpentry that I've done was working for a cabinet maker for a year, and so I kind of felt comfortable with that. And I think I ended up doing like, you know, 45 cabinet doors and drawer fronts, like, you know, all shaker style, which is like pretty intense. Bit of work.
That's a lot of cabinetry. Yeah.
Well, the bedroom itself only has 27 drawers and cabinets that you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
You know, looking at it, you wouldn't think there's that many. And then there's even more storage under the bed supports.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of place to put stuff.
I would say that some of my favorite tiny houses often have really exceptional cabinetry. I mean, it really makes the space.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, from a design point of view, it dictates a lot of the rooms, I think.
Yeah. Now, with your designs, were you doing them on paper and SketchUp, some combination? How did you approach the design work?
Yeah, it was, we just drew everything kind of in plan format initially, and then we found some funny little program called, the name escapes me. It's like a SketchUp program, but it's free, and it's kind of largely for interior design. And
Sweet Home.
And so it works
Sweet Home
well.
3D?
Sweet Home.
I love Sweet Home 3D.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's got such a silly kind of name, but yeah, it actually works really well.
For those listening, it's like an open source light version of SketchUp that is, you know, it's got a lot of pre-existing elements in it, like cabinets and countertops and things like that. But it's really easy to use, and it's actually fairly powerful, I think.
Yeah, I was really surprised. And, yeah. And you can bring in SketchUp.
Yep. All the models, objects. Like
anything. So objects. So it's actually quite good in that respect. And yeah, you can do walkthroughs and mm-hmm. stuff. Like, to me, the 3D kind of aspect of it, where you can walk through a room, was really quite powerful. Although, yeah, we designed spaces, and then my wife and I would go and walk in the space, and we realized that, yeah, you still need to, yeah, you can't rely completely on that to kind of give you the full impression. Like, we thought, well, we could fit a 3-seater, you know, couch in the lounge room, and then we're like, no, we can't. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It just looks like that when you're designing it on the screen.
Yeah, it's like the world's tightest 3 seats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was actually an early design idea. Was actually, we were going to put a bump out as well. Like, so we had this whole idea with using sips and so on to sort of have a section that could be pushed on the outside of the living room area. And then that's where the couch would go, freeing up more kind of, you know, space in the middle there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're like, the place is 320 square feet already. Why are we trying to add even more space? I mean, it's supposed to be a tiny house. So, and it also was looking like an engineering kind of nightmare. So I just kind of left it out.
Yeah. Tell me about your utilities. Are you on the grid for power and for water and for all those things?
We were sort of semi off grid when we were building it. And then we kind of assumed that that's the direction we were going to end up going. But then with some random luck, the place that we're at now actually had a tiny house on it already.
Okay.
And somebody had gone to great lengths and investment to put power and water to, and actually like a little pad for the parking pad.
Oh, wow.
Had done all this kind of work. And then they were there for a month, and they decided that tiny house living didn't work for them. And
oh my gosh.
Sold the place.
Wow.
So we kind of waltzed in, and it was like, I think they had invested like $6,000 or something like that.
Wow.
And so we're like, okay, well, yeah, we'll just plug in and, you know, plug into water, plug into power. So nice. That's actually been surprisingly smooth and easy.
Yeah, that sounds really nice.
But we were certainly prepared to go off grid. I think that was kind of the original, the original plan.
Nice. And so you've added a second, you mentioned it earlier, a second trailer. And what are the plans for that one?
Yeah, so when we were building the other one, we were living in tents initially, which was a complete disaster for about 5 months. And so we thought, well, why, if these things are so cheap, why not just buy one and live in it temporarily and then sell it off when we're finished with it? And then, you know, once we had situated ourselves in the new place, we thought, well, we need like a shed to put my tools in, and we need, you know, place for garden stuff. And, you know, we'd always talked about, you know, it'd be really nice to offer hospitality to, you know, friends or family and stuff. And it's just a bit too tight in our space to do that on a regular basis. So we thought, okay, well, why don't we just keep the trailer that we already have and just fit it out for a little bit of extra storage for, you know, those kind of awkward things like, you know, sports kind of stuff and camping gear and all that. And then just make a little multi-purpose space that's like a guest room with a bath. And then that could be, you know, my wife likes to sew, and so like she can sort of spread out and do that kind of thing. Just sort of a hobby room as well. So I'm just sort of in the process of getting that fitted out at the moment.
Nice. And judging from your accent, sorry to pry, you sound like you're an American. So how did you find yourself in Australia? And now living in Australia, in a tiny home.
Yeah, well, I've got the muddled accent probably now. Nobody knows where to place me. So yeah, I'm actually Canadian.
Okay, sorry.
But I've been in Australia for 20 years now. So yeah, West Coast Canadian.
Okay.
I'm actually in Canada at the moment, oddly enough, because I'm visiting with my parents who needed a bit of help with some sort of medical related stuff. But
okay.
But yeah, usually I'd be calling in from Australia at this point.
Okay.
But yeah, sort of a hybrid of, and I'm half Dutch as well. My mom's Dutch. So
okay.
I don't know how that figures in with the accent.
No, so I had to ask.
Yeah, that's all right.
and apologies.
You're East Coast.
What's that?
You're East Coast.
Yeah,
US,
yeah,
right?
I'm in Vermont. in the US.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Well, it's a really great build, and I encourage people to check out the photos on the show notes page for this episode, which will be at thetinyhouse.net/293, episode 293. And I also wanted to ask, you have a YouTube channel yourself, and you mentioned a build series, which I'm excited to dig into. What's your YouTube channel? What kind of things are you doing there?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a video production background, and while I was building the house, I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to make a big production of this and make it into some big documentary, but I thought it was pertinent to kind of record stuff.
Absolutely.
But then, you know, my video production side self was like, as soon as you sit down in the edit suite, it's like, oh, let's make this interesting and put some music and make it fun. So yeah, there's a kind of a 14-part series. So my channel, my YouTube channel is Big Tiny Adventure.
Okay.
And likewise, I've got a bigtinyadventure.com, which is like our blog and links to, you know, social media stuff and so on.
Nice.
So yeah, the current kind of, you know, direction is that, you know, we thought, well, why don't we do a little bit of kind of living in the house and talk about minimalist living to people who are interested in tiny house living and, you know, housing crisis and what they can do, you know, for in different capacities to get into a tiny house if that's kind of, if they're kind of a bit in need and so on. So it's all very, very new, but I'm kind of, that's kind of evolution of the channel I hope to go with.
Nice. That sounds great. I look forward to following along.
Cool.
Well, one thing that I like to ask all my guests is, what are two or three resources that you would recommend that helped you out on your project?
Yeah, well, I really value kind of in-person kind of stuff.
Nice.
You know, anytime, you know, basically before we built, we always went to tiny house kind of meetup type things. There was, you know, anytime there was a tiny house expo, just sort of hobnobbing with people and picking people's brains for stuff. And everybody's so, it's such a good community in the sense that people are always willing to, you know, give advice or invite you to their builds and help you can do hands-on stuff.
That's awesome.
I think all that kind of, you know, hands-on stuff is fantastic to do. But yeah, absolutely. YouTube was my biggest friend.
Yep.
It's amazing how many generous people there are online that are willing to share what they're doing and,
absolutely,
you know, give you all these great tips and stuff. So yeah, those things were invaluable to me.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Mike Crowhurst, thank you so much. It was really fantastic to meet you. And you know, I again encourage folks to go over to thetinyhouse.net/293. We'll have photos of the houses, or I guess really just the one house. The second one, I'm sure there'll be photos of it once it's ready.
Yeah.
And to the YouTube channel and the Living Big in a Tiny House tour. So thanks so much.
Yeah, no, it's been great. And yeah, if anybody's got any direct interest in semi-trailer kind of conversions, then yeah, absolutely hit me up with questions. I'm totally happy to help you out. But yeah, it's been great to be here. And I really appreciate you having me on, Ethan.
Thank you so much to Mike Crowhurst for being a guest on the show today. You can find the show notes, including a complete transcript, links to Mike's YouTube channel and website, and lots of photos of this beautiful tiny house at thetinyhouse.net/293. Again, that's thetinyhouse.net/293. Well, that's all for this week. I'm your host, Ethan Waldman, and I'll be back next week with another episode of the Tiny House Lifestyle Podcast.